facial recognition software has been used by police departments and counterterrorism agents for years, but now it's starting to creep into our everyday lives.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now for a look at that and other stories from the worlds of science and technology. She's senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us each month at this time. Gemma, welcome back.
Happy science to you both.
Well, how does this facial recognition software work nowadays?
Well, in a lot of different ways. It's really interesting the strides they've making, and this is quite frankly a case where the development of the technology is really outpacing kind of how we've decided legally and culturally to deal with this technology. And right now, facial recognition, you know, for years, mugshots, passport photos, good lighting, straight on shot, computers are great, and they have been for years, at recognizing people in those conditions. But now they're developing special new types of deep learning techniques so that they can pick up someone if it's a very dark photo or a blurry photo or their face is mostly turned away. The computers are learning to recognize those faces, and this is a huge leap forward, technologically speaking.
Now, you said that we haven't quite figured out how we're going to use it and when it's allowed, but how available is this technology to the public right now?
Well, it's not just one monolithic technology. There are a lot of different algorithms, a lot of different ways of doing the facial recognition. And, you know, law enforcement has a lot of techniques. I would say they're the most advanced, and they're growing all the time, and they're expanding the number of databases and the levels of law enforcement, you know, county, state, federal, international, that have access to that. But if you think about it, you know, if you're on Facebook, you are dealing with facial recognition already in your life, because Facebook and Google and a number of other social media applications have various ways of, you know, whether it's tagging someone and saying, hey, yeah, this is my friend so-and-so, or just even recognizing someone. And I have to say, I don't know about you two, but if you're shoplifters, yeah, facial recognition is being used by stores now to identify shoplifters, so watch out.
And not just shoplifters, but maybe this could be used for shoppers, period. Hey, we've got this face profile, and now we've got these cameras in stores. Rob, we saw you've been lingering by snack cakes, so we're going to send you a coupon for those. Is that the present or the near future?
Yeah, that is one of the very creepy potentials that, and you know, it depends how you want to define it, whether that particular technology is actually here or just around the corner. There was an app called NameTag that had ways of, you know, you snap a photo of someone, or let's say you walk into the store and the store's camera takes a photo of you and can run you against the database and identify your name and occupation and address. There are those kinds of applications. They're not widespread, and some of them, quite frankly, have not really been tested in a real-world setting, but certainly the technology is increasingly out there and it's increasingly available. So it could be happening, and really, there are only a couple states that have any kind of laws on the books about how to deal with this kind of technology.
Right. It sounds like the ethical questions are still to be answered, and maybe even the questions themselves are being formulated. So what are the big questions that we have to think about?
Well, I think the really big question is, how are we going to use this technology? You know, the writer in our story makes a terrific point that technologies are famously neutral, and it's really we, the people using them, who decide whether to use them for good or ill. Would it be great to identify a terrorist through facial recognition software before he or she did something really horrific? Absolutely. But can that same technology be used to identify, you know, Rob, you walking into a store and suddenly having your cell phone go off with a special coupon for your favorite brand of whatever? So we really need to have attention working it out. And it's kind of interesting that attempts to figure out how to do this have been really shaky, because businesses are like, yeah, I want to be able to take a picture of someone and send them a special coupon for their favorite product. And there's a lot of pushback from a lot of different corners. So it's really a huge to be decided.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, our monthly look at the most intriguing stories from the world of science and technology. Let's move on to another one, Gemma, the Pygmalion effect. I remember the play and the musical based thereon, but what is it? What is Pygmalion in the world of science?
Well, this goes back to an experiment that happened about 51 years ago, where a academic came into a classroom, actually a whole school, and administered what he said was a special test. And this test identified particular students who were going to bloom that year academically. And he came back at the end of the year and found, wow, the students that took this test and the specific ones that he said, yes, they bloomed, they actually did much better, and they were, you know, quote-unquote blooming. Then the teachers who were teaching these students all along found out that the whole thing was a bit of a farce. It was just a basic IQ test that he had administered, and he picked children completely at random to tell them, to tell their teachers, oh, these kids are going to bloom. And it was actually the teachers knowing that subconsciously, they had higher expectations for those children, and that in turn led to the children doing better. And it's called the Pygmalion effect, and it's actually been seen in a number of areas since he identified it in 1964. The problem is it only works if it's subconscious. You know, like if you're in on it and you know that it's just a totally random thing that higher expectations have been assigned to this person, not because they show signs of being, you know, more academically clever, what have you, but just because they've been picked at random, if you actually know they've been picked at random, it will not work. But if it's subconscious, the teacher, whether it's through nonverbal cues or other means, has higher expectations and the child performs better. It's one of those crazy things that science just goes, huh?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's fascinating results there, but how do you actually put that to work in real life for good? I mean, on the one hand, it also seems sort of,
ethically,
you know, ethically
suspect.
For those kids who didn't get the stamp of approval, that might have been a painful year.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, one of the things is they can't really tinker around by repeating the test and trying to replicate the results. They can't do that now because, yes, there are serious ethical concerns now. But one of the things they're looking into now is, you know, I mentioned nonverbal cues, nonverbal communication, and it's amazing the amount of information we convey without saying a word, whether it's the tilt of our head, the raise of our eyebrows. And so they're now actually training teachers to be thinking about that nonverbal communication and to really be putting out sort of more positive nonverbal communication. Because, you know, if you think a child is going to do great, maybe you give them a facial expression subconsciously that encourages them. And, you know, the opposite is true, too. If you've kind of unfortunately written a child off, maybe you're going to express that nonverbally through your facial expressions, your body language. So now they're training teachers to sort of have higher expectations and express them nonverbally. And it's a really interesting science. The jury's not in, because this part of the program is really new, but wouldn't it be great if we could just help children by increasing our expectations of them in a way that, you know, just nonverbally, just a tilt of the head? Wow. Wouldn't it be great if we could do that?
And are people trying to do this now in classrooms?
Yeah. They're training teachers in classrooms, and there are a few different programs out there and taking a few different approaches, but they're actually starting to do this. And as I said, it's a little too early to have concrete results, but the preliminary results are pretty positive.
We're going to wrap up right now talking about lava.
A hot topic.
Oh. Sorry, Gemma. That was wrong for
you. I love the lava.
So tell us, there's a lot of crazy stuff about lava that we didn't know. What's at the top of your list?
Oh, my gosh. My favorite kind of lava. It's just this banana stuff from, it's one spot in Tanzania. I can't pronounce this word, Oldonyolengai. It's this volcano that has this black natural carbonatite lava that is still very fluid at a, you know, respectively low temperature, just 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and it turns this beautiful silver color. It's like something from Lord of the Rings when you see photos of this place, and I just think, wow, that is so attractive. I would love to have a fountain of that in the middle of my room as a centerpiece.
Except for having, you know, molten lava and the temperatures and the safety risks, I imagine.
Oh, details.
So I didn't think of it. I mean, I guess lava is going to vary depending on the mineral composition of where it's coming up from. It never occurred to me.
Yeah, the mineral composition, the temperature, and there are so many other factors. In fact, the most common kind of lava, basaltic, thankfully, is kind of the least dangerous. Other types of lava, including andesitic and rhyolitic, they have a lot more gas, actually, it trapped inside. So, you know, when they blow up, they blow up. You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of good that basaltic is the most common, I think.
And lava isn't just relegated to planet Earth. It sounds like it's a fairly active thing on other planets.
Absolutely. Whether you look at our own solar system, you know, Mars has the tallest mountain in our solar system that we know of. It's called Olympus Mons, and it's really just an enormous basaltic volcano. So you've got that on Mars. You've got, you know, there are some moons of Jupiter and such that are just like basically full of lava that erupts in these massive curtains that are just hundreds of miles long. And it's absolutely fascinating. And some of the exoplanets that we're finding just appear to be like great balls of lava.
And briefly, Gemma, as we wrap up, a lava here on Earth could have played a role in the extinction of dinosaurs.
Yes, yes. You know, we all know about that giant asteroid that slammed kind of more or less into Cancun about 66 million years ago. Well, it looks like when the asteroid slammed into Cancun, it kind of really rattled the planet, and it set off monstrous, monstrous flows of lava in India, in what's now India. It's called the Deccan Traps, and it looks like that huge explosion may have also released enough poisonous gas that killed poor T-Rex and all those other dinos.
Wow. Well, Gemma, cool stuff. I mean, hot stuff. Sorry. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Always fun. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about the coolest science news.
And every Monday in December at this time, we'll break down the science stories of the year from Discover Magazine's Year in Science issue. We'll kick that off on Monday, December 7th.